Horace lifted his head from the pillow. He thought he'd heard a noise, but everything was quiet. It must have been a dream. Trying to clear his mind, he closed his eyes again. He sat up and looked across the dark room. The door moved slightly, as if someone was pushing against it. A sense of enormous power swept over Horace. He swung his legs over the side of the bed to check it out. As his feet touched the floor, a sudden pain penetrated his chest. He stood up, but the agony boring through his breastbone made breathing difficult. Through the pain, he saw an inky shadow play across his bedroom door. It looked like a black rope or a serpent crawling through the crack between the door and the jamb. A second identical shadow joined it, and then a third. Before Horace could take a full step, the door was ripped out of its frame. He stopped, fear seizing his insides as something heavy pounded on the floor, hard enough to send vibrations up his legs. Then something hard struck him in the chest, catapulting him over the mattress and onto the floor on the other side. He never saw what hit him. He barely had time to clamber to his knees before a powerful grip seized him by the back of the neck. A hot wind blew in his face. He reached up behind his head in an effort to break free. His blood turned cold as his fingers closed around a huge, hairy wrist as big around as his thigh, iron hard with corded sinew under leathery flesh. Sharp nails dug into his neck as the massive arm threw him across the room. Horace struck the wardrobe shoulder first. He burst through the door panel and fell half inside and half out of the cabinet. Pulling himself out of the wardrobe, he felt a sharp pain jabbing him under the ribs. Looking down, he saw a piece of wood sticking out of his right side. Blood soaked into his clothes. He pulled on the end of the giant splinter, and it came free. He swayed back against the frame of the wardrobe, just as a line of raw agony ripped across his abdomen. More blood dripped from a set of three parallel cuts that ran across his stomach from hip to hip, like he'd been attacked by some wild beast. With memories of the Kurgaru fresh in his mind, he twisted away and flung himself toward the door. Something thin and rope-like caught his ankle, and he sprawled headlong onto the floor. He clawed his way to one of the bed's footposts and hauled himself up. His fear vanished. Fingertips tingling, Horace opened himself to the power. The pain of his injuries was shoved away. All he could feel was the Zoanna urging him to lash out. He turned around. A huge shape rose before him, the top of its head almost brushing the 10-foot-high ceiling. Although he couldn't make out any details in the dark, he knew at once it was nothing human, and nothing like any animal he'd ever seen either. Rubbery appendages hung from its head, wriggling like a nest of serpents, and horn-like projections rose from the backs of its long arms. Clenching his teeth to keep from vomiting, Horace thrust out his right hand. The power inside him erupted, not from his outstretched hand, but from his chest. The pain flared inside him, so powerful that his vision dimmed and his muscles locked up in an agonizing rictus. Strangest of all, he didn't see anything happen. No ray of fire shot across the room, no orb of ice or stone, no gust of wind. Nothing at all like the elemental dominions he'd been taught about. And yet the creature staggered back as if it had been struck by a battering ram. Horace winced as he poured out more of his power, concentrating through the rising pain. Starlight filtered through a cloud of dust, forming behind the creature where his power was chewing a hole in the wall. The monster tried to resist the invisible force, swiping at the air with its hooked talons, yet it could not reach him. Horace looked around. He could hold the creature at bay, it seemed, but it would be on him the moment he let up. He didn't see how he could get to Alira without releasing it. A large shape loomed in Horace's peripheral vision. He ducked. But too late, as the chair crashed into him, heaved by his attacker. The heavy furniture struck him on the side of the shoulder and spun him completely around. He grasped the bedpost to keep from falling. His right arm felt like it had been torn from the socket. He shoved away from the post as the beast's shadow towered over him. With no time to think, he just reacted. His power flared again, and again there was no visible effect, but he sensed a sudden and dreadful connection to the creature, throbbing in his hand as if he held the creature's beating heart. He could feel the blood pumping through that mighty muscle, strong and fierce. Horace wasn't sure what he was doing, but in that instant he didn't care. He squeezed his fingers. The creature halted, grasping its chest with both hands. Horace tightened his fist, and the creature teetered back, tearing his own flesh away in bloody strips to dig inside. Spurred on by his behavior, Horace twisted his fist sideways and yanked. The creature fell on its side with an impact that shook the floor. It didn't move. Horace ran for the door. The sitting parlor was dark, but enough starlight came through the large window for him to navigate between the divans. He kicked open Alira's door. Candlelight flickered against the walls and cast deep shadows in the corners of the small room. Alira stood against the far wall, her white tunic drenched in blood from long scratches across her upper chest. She waved a long knife back and forth as if fending off something she couldn't see. Horace reached for his powers again. He found it more difficult this time, like trying to exercise a fatigued muscle. The magic came back slowly instead of the instant rush he'd felt before. Once it came, though, his view of the room changed. A horrible, squat shape with a dog-like snout appeared in front of Alira. It pawed the air, trying to get past her weapon. Ignoring his throbbing shoulder, Horace snatched up the chair beside Alira's desk and approached the creature from behind. Alira glanced up, and her eyes grew wide as she looked over his head.
Behind you!
A heavy weight dropped on his back. Claws dug into his shoulders as he was knocked to the floor. The chair fell out of his grip. He found himself pinned face down by what felt like a small pony perched on his lower back. He tried to push up, but his right arm was useless, and his left lacked the strength to move both him and his assailant. Deep scratches opened across Alira's knee, and she slashed with her knife, but the creature stayed beyond her reach. Then Horace's vision was wrenched away as the thing on top of him yanked his head back by the hair. Thin claws grasped for the front of his throat. He struggled to buck the creature off his back, but he was held fast. Blood dribbled down his neck as the claws dug deeper. Then the grasp holding him went limp, and the weight slid off his back. He scrambled away. Another small demon lay on the floor with a knife hilt protruding from its throat. Alira jumped up on her bed as the other creature swiped at her ankles. Horace lunged and grabbed it by the bony leg. A fierce heat erupted inside him, filling him with tremendous strength. He jerked his arm and flung the creature across the room. Its impact dented the stone wall and knocked mortar loose from the ceiling. The dog-faced thing dropped beside its brother and did not move again. Yellow ichor dripped from its head, which was caved in down to the bridge of its snout. Horace rolled over onto his back. The fire inside him was dwindling, leaving him wrung out and exhausted. Alira sat on her bed, her chin drooping to her lacerated chest. He crawled over to her and touched her leg, careful not to aggravate her wounds.
Are you all right?
I think so. What about your... Oh, your arm!
His right arm hung slack, leaking blood from several cuts and a deep tear where it joined to his shoulder. Oddly, it didn't hurt too badly. Then his sense of balance abandoned him without warning. Alira caught him by his good arm as he fell back against the wall with a minimal amount of jarring.
I'm okay. Just give me a moment.
Alira grabbed a sheet from her bed and tied it around his injured arm.
I've heard about your powers, but I never believed... I mean, to see the Zoanna in action, it's amazing.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. One day I'm just a normal guy, and the next I'm a... I don't know, a freak.
You're not a freak! We would be dead if not for what you did.
So scared. I couldn't control it.
You didn't look scared to me. You look brave, like an angel of vengeance. All you needed was a flaming sword.
The front door had been forced open. He stood up, grimacing as the room tilted around him.
I'll take care of it.
No, we're both going out there together.
Alira...
Having already retrieved her knife from the dead demon, Alira headed through the broken doorway, and Horace had no choice but to go with her. They stepped into the sitting area. Bright light shone from the foyer. With Alira beside him, Horace lifted his good hand, intent on unleashing whatever power he had left on the first thing that walked through the archway. A pair of the Queen's guards shouldered their way into the room with swords bared. While the soldiers searched the bedchambers, Horace sat on the arm of a divan. Alira curled up beside him.
They say people heard horrible noises throughout the palace.
Those things make enough racket to wake the dead. What in the Almighty's name were they?
I don't know. When they appeared, all I could think of was...
Demons.
Yes, just like the stories my mother told me when I was little.
I've seen the images carved in the walls of the Basilica at Arnos. They don't look anything like those creatures.
Oh. Osipa, Lady of the Moon, watch over your city, for we are beset by darkness in the night and need your light to guide our footsteps. Protect us from the evils of the world until we return to the safety and comfort of your breast.
The alabaster statue of the goddess towered over Byleth as she whispered the supplication in the inner sanctum of the Moon Temple, where only royalty and the High Priestess were allowed to enter. Though not as grandiose as the Temple of Amur on the other side of the Street of Gods, this shrine was larger than most palaces. It had been the spiritual heart of the city since its founding, whatever the Sun Cult might choose to believe. When she was a girl, she hadn't paid much attention to the priestesses or their teachings, which had seemed out of touch with the real world. Yet as she grew older, the gods seemed nearer to her every day, especially the patroness of her city.
Lady Goddess, tell me what to do. What advice would you have given my father?
She had been thinking about her father more and more in recent days. After years of hating him for throwing his life away, she finally felt she had begun to understand him. The throne was not as comfortable as it appeared from afar. Almost all the noble houses had abandoned her over the past few weeks as her wedding day approached. They had been seduced by the Sun Temple. She was alone, except for a handful of viziers and court functionaries. Byleth bowed to the goddess and turned away. Mother Iltani stood in the doorway. Though her face was lined with deep wrinkles, her smile was warm and vibrant. Byleth had known the High Priestess of Sipa for most of her life.
Someone is waiting for you, Majesty, in the nave.
Thank you. I'm done here.
The priestess joined her at the center of the room and took her hands. She looked up, and Byleth followed her gaze through the round hole in the ceiling. The three-quarters full moon shone down on them.
I've been praying for you, Majesty, right here, every night. A prayer to the Silver Lady to deliver you from the forces that threaten our city.
I appreciate that. I hope the Lady answers, and soon.
She will or she will not. As I told your father many times in this very chamber, it is not for us to command the gods, but to listen and bend to their wishes. That goes for kings and queens, as well as for the farmers in their fields and the cooks in the kitchen.
And what would you have advised my father if he was in my position?
That even the tallest tree must bend before the storm or be broken by its fury.
Byleth kissed the priestess's cheek and left the chamber. She found Lord Malsabar in the temple's main chamber, standing before a marble frieze.
I didn't think I would see you again this night, my lord.
Forgive me for intruding on your majesty's devotions.
I was finished anyway. I'm not much for kneeling and praying, even though I could use the divine assistance. What of our new first sword?
I saw him back to his rooms at the palace. He may have celebrated his good fortune a bit too much.
Byleth caught the evasive sideward glance.
You still don't approve of his promotion?
Well, it's not for me to...
Forget decorum, Musibar. Speak plainly.
No, I don't believe it was in the best interests.
Whose best interest? Horace's or my own?
Both. Lord Horace is very powerful, but he's not in full control of his Zoanna. Furthermore, he doesn't possess the knowledge or political acumen to act as a proper first sword. Lord Hunzu
failed to protect his queen. He was given a warrior's death, which was much more than he rightfully deserved after the catastrophe in the desert.
That much is true. Yet Lord Horace isn't prepared to handle this responsibility. He has no allies and no protection outside of your majesty's favor.
What about you? I was under the impression that you thought highly of our visitor from across the sea.
I do. He is intelligent, thoughtful, and not at all what I imagined a man from the West would be like. However, forgive me, Majesty, but elevating Lord Horace to the Zoanii caste will not solve your impending troubles.
Oh, am I that obvious, my lord?
Only to someone who has known you since birth. Forgive my candor, but your court will never accept Lord Horace as your royal consort, much less their new king. And if I may, it would only make your situation more untenable. If I have spoken too freely, please accept my sincere apology. But you are my primary concern, Majesty. Your protection and the continuation of your line.
Yes, yes. No one is questioning your loyalty, Lord Mulcibar. You've given more than anyone has a right to ask. Have you found out anything new about the crash?
Nothing of note, Majesty. I've placed Lord Gilgan's family and acquaintances under surveillance, including his brother. I don't expect to find anything. House Mama Unorthos has nothing to gain by your Majesty's demise, and everything to lose.
When they had returned from the crash, Byleth's first action had been to summon Jantu and force him to submit to a thorough mind-sifting. She'd found no hint of disloyalty in him, nothing that tied him to Gilgun's treachery. In fact, when she had informed him of the events on the riverbank, he had been genuinely enraged that his twin brother could do such a thing. But she was no closer to understanding why Gilgan would betray her. She had known both brothers since they were children. The treachery was a bitter knife in her breast.
What about the other nobles?
They are restless, Majesty.
A result of naming a savage as my first sword, without a doubt.
Quite possible. But I would have heard if any of the city's major houses were planning an attempt on this scale.
Forgive me, my lord. We both know who was behind both attacks.
You mean the Cult of Amur?
Of course. Who else has the means and the audacity to strike at the crown? I'd wager that slug Rimesh was behind it.
That is a bold accusation. One that should not be voiced in court without some form of proof. There have already been demonstrations in public squares, Your Majesty.
Riots?
Not as yet, but the temple soldiers do nothing to quell the civil unrest, and so it grows. If you'll heed my counsel, now is not the time for a confrontation.
Then what? Shall I ignore that a menarch tried to have me killed?
I'm only suggesting that we proceed with care. Allow me to make more inquiries, gather evidence. If the Sun Temple was behind these attacks, I'll find out.
Fine. We'll do as you suggest for now. But time is running short.
I will do everything in my power.
I know you will. Come to me the moment you learn anything.
Of course. And there is one other matter. This is a matter I am loath to discuss with your Majesty, but I feel I must.
Go on, my lord.
It concerns Lord Astapta, Majesty. Majesty, I fear you might have entered into an unsafe arrangement with his lordship. Please forgive an old man, but I swore a sacred oath to your father to watch over you and protect you in all matters. I clearly failed in regard to Lord Gilgan, but I do not wish to fail again.
I appreciate your concern, my lord, but my dealings with Lord Astapta do not fall under your purview.
As you say, Majesty.
As the old nobleman started to leave, two soldiers in royal uniform entered the temple.
Majesty!
What is it?
The palace! There has been an attack!
On the royal residence?
No, my lord. In the first sword's rooms.
The iron desert surrounded them, an ocean of sand and scattered stones with a few clumps of scrub brush clinging to life. The sun's blazing rays reflected off the white dunes. The company marched through the wastes in a loose line, double file for the most part, but the officers showed little inclination to enforce formation discipline. They had set out from Aragosh 3 days ago, a convoy of 400 troopers, 60-some officers, 21 supply wagons, and a complement of cooks, armorers, and drovers. They spent the first day on the river, sailing west in a convoy of barges, and disembarked at a small hamlet with no name. Then they marched northwest. The soldiers hadn't been given a destination, only a general heading, but Eminon's contacts had ferreted out these details within an hour on the road. They were going to a town called Omikur. According to the rumors, that was where the invader army was holed up. Joram wiped his brow with the back of his forearm.
You men, tighten up into a diamond formation.
The dog soldiers squinted at him as if gauging his seriousness, but they moved. Shakur hustled to take the point position.
Attention! Make way!
A cavalry regiment rode up from the rear of the column. Kapikul Hazael rode in their midst, his dark eyes scanning the troops. A junior officer stood up in his stirrups.
Who leads the squad?
I do.
The Capicul wants to know why these soldiers are in a sword formation. Assemble them in double file at once!
Double file!
The men rushed into the new formation with practiced ease. The Capicul rode ahead up the line with his bodyguards.
Half rations for 2 days!
The officer kicked his steed to catch up with the others.
Looking good, lads.
Heads turned as Emanon appeared among them. The rebel captain was all smiles, as if this were a pleasant stroll instead of a brutal march into the heart of the most dangerous desert north of the Zaral.
The men look good. They're responding well to you.
Is that so?
Well, perhaps you're a bit hard on them. We're revolutionaries. We aren't used to military discipline, eh?
Didn't you tell me I could run this platoon how I saw fit?
I did.
Then let me run it.
So be it. I just came to tell you to be ready.
What? Escape? Are you insane?
Not now, but everyone needs to be ready. We'll be arriving soon.
That caught Jaram's attention. He shaded his eyes to peer over the heads of the soldiers marching ahead of him. It took him a minute, but he finally spotted a dark smudge against the horizon. That had to be Omegur, unless it was another mirage.
We won't reach it before nightfall.
Word is that we'll stop an hour before sunset to make camp and approach the town in the morning.
Understood. What about getting us extra water rations?
Emanon pointed over his shoulder. A wagon loaded with clay jars rolled up from the rear of the column.
Already taken care of. And I have something else for you. A piece of information from Erugash. Your friend, Horace, has joined the Queen's court.
What are you talking about?
That's what my sources are saying. He's the new first sword of Her Majesty's Guard. I don't have to tell you that's a sensitive post. She must trust him an awful lot. All right, I have other people to see. Keep your eyes open and remember, be
ready. Yes.
Right. See you later.
The rebel captain jogged ahead, sliding through the ranks easily. The sun glared down as the army marched onward. The call to halt had come down an hour before sundown, just as Emanon had predicted. Jaram got them fed and let them sleep, taking the first watch for himself. The sun was setting behind Omakur's ramparts. Lights twinkled in the towers, studding the long curtain wall. Jaram wondered about the people inside. He'd heard that the Crusaders had allowed the town's inhabitants to leave in peace when they occupied the town. About half had taken the offer, leaving with as much food and water as they could carry, but the rest, as many as 1,000 people, had chosen to stay. Why? Jaram knew Akeshian tactics, having fought against them enough times in the past. He had seen it firsthand. The people inside, the civilians, had to know they would receive no mercy when the legions took back the town. Many would die, savagely and painfully. The soldiers would sate themselves with rape and looting, and the survivors would be sold into slavery. It was madness to resist.
Hail! Do I need to know a password before I can approach?
Yes, it's asshole.
The rebel captain walked up to Jaram, surveying the sleeping soldiers. 2 men had fallen down dead on the first day of the forced march, and 6 more on the second day. Jaram's platoon hadn't lost anyone yet, mainly because he made sure they got plenty of water throughout the day.
I'm amazed you didn't have to kill anyone tonight.
Me too. How many did we lose today?
13.
Well, we're here. Now what?
We've been attached to the 3rd Legion, the Queen's Silver Demons.
Charming name.
They're charming lads, I'm sure. They've had the town under siege for almost a fortnight now. Earthworks and siege weapons, your kind of stuff.
Any luck with the gates?
Not from what I've heard. Omikur's a tough nut to crack. The walls are 30 feet high in most places, and at least 10 paces thick. The gates are sheathed in iron.
How many defenders?
The command is guessing about 2,000.
That means 3,000 at least.
More. My friends tell me there are freed slaves on those walls.
That's why they didn't leave when they had the chance. The foreigners offered the slaves their freedom. You aren't planning to sneak inside and join the defense, are you?
No, I'm not that crazy. I feel for those poor bastards inside, but I'm not suicidal.
So what are we going to do?
Just follow orders for now, and be...
ready. Don't you ever get tired of saying that?
Eminon grinned in response. Jerome was about to ask for more details on the secret plan when a bright green light illuminated the sky. Black clouds formed over the town, despite the fact that the sky had been clear all day. A powerful wind sprung up out of nowhere, showering the camp in sand. Lightning struck several times in succession, most of the jagged green bolts landing inside the city. Horns were heard in the gathering night as fires sprung up within the walls. The wind continued to whip over the camp. The storm lasted for the better part of an hour, and then slowly died down until it ended altogether. The clouds dissipated to reveal a firmament of twinkling stars. Jerome looked around his camp.
Chakur, get a fire going. Minak, you're on watch.
Get some sleep. We'll be up early tomorrow.
Jerome nodded, though sleep seemed leagues away. He watched the rebel captain leave the same way he had come, over the trench and off into the night. Horace shifted in the bed to find a better position, but the ache in his shoulder made returning to sleep impossible. He plucked at the sling binding his arm to his chest. He flexed the fingers of his right hand to get the blood moving and was rewarded with painful tingles under the layers of bandages. The past few days had been a whirlwind. After the attack of the demon creatures, he had been given alternate accommodations, which he didn't mind in the least. He didn't know if he would ever have been comfortable sleeping in that suite again. The queen gifted him with a new home, one of the estates that surrounded the palace. The house was gorgeous, more angular and blocky than an Arnasi manor, but still possessing the clean, solid lines of Eastern architecture. Built entirely of salmon-colored marble, the manor gleamed like mother of pearl in the sunlight. He couldn't believe that it now belonged to him. He'd grown up with a small degree of affluence, but his father could never have afforded a manor estate such as this. Through the window, he saw the enclosed garden below. Like many Akeshian homes, this one was built around a central courtyard. Broad green fronds shaded the pavestones around a spraying fountain carved to resemble a great long-nosed beast that he had been told was an elephant. He had a magnificent view of the city over the stone walls. The palace rose above everything only a short distance away. All this luxury, he didn't know how to react to it. Only weeks ago he had been a captive with a collar around his neck. Now he congregated with lords and a queen.
It's all because of the magic. Without it, I'd be back in irons before lunchtime.
A soldier in scale armor strode across the courtyard, his head moving from side to side as he patrolled the grounds. Her Majesty had sent him a squad of 10 soldiers hand-picked from her own bodyguard. They were supposed to belong to him now, along with 20 house slaves, including a cook and a horsemaster. Horace had wanted to return the slaves and bodyguards until Alira convinced him it would be a grave insult to the queen. So he had freed the slaves instead and offered them gainful employment, paid for by the generous stipend he received as first sword. Alira seemed to approve. As the sentry disappeared into an archway toward the kitchen, Horace got up and dressed himself one-handed. By the time he was finished, the door opened and two soldiers entered. The taller of them was Pamuthas, the captain of his guard. They followed Horace to the kitchen, where he picked up some oranges, pastries, and a carafe of juice, and balancing a tray in his good arm, he went to find Alira. Her suite was on the upper floor in what was called the Mistress Chamber. The term had been almost enough to make him blush until Alira explained that mistress didn't carry the same connotation in Akeshia as it did back home. Any female relative was given the title if she was unmarried and living under the same roof as a male. A female servant was exiting Alira's room as Horace reached the landing. She bowed and scurried off, but left the door open. He was trying to figure out how he could knock without a free hand when Pamuthas rapped on the doorframe. Horace nodded his thanks to the man.
Manuhi!
It's me. May I come in?
The door opened all the way, and Alira stood there in a nightgown of peach-colored silk. She stepped aside to allow Horace to enter. He set down the tray on a small mahogany table.
Good morning, Horace.
Sobetir, Beleta.
Beleti.
Beleti, damn. Thought I had it perfect.
Don't fret. You're getting much better, if one can overlook your accent.
That bad?
Dreadful.
I'll keep working on it. How did you sleep?
Well, thank you for this.
But Horace hardly heard her. The sight of her biting into the roll reminded him of a time he sat on a hillside above the bay at Tynes again, staring at his wife.
Horace?
Sorry. For a moment, I was somewhere else.
It's all right. As long as you're back now.
I'm all yours. Say, I was wondering if you'd like to take a walk. It's a beautiful day.
Whatever you'd like. I mean, I wish I could, but I was going to see a friend today.
Oh, in that case, perhaps we could...
Pamuthas poked his head in the door.
Pardon the interruption. Lord Mulcibar is here to see you.
Please admit Mulcibar and make him comfortable.
You planned this.
What?
Lord Mulcibar's arrival. It's rather convenient that he shows up unannounced right as you're going out. Who is this friend, anyway?
Am I free?
What? Of course you are.
If I am no longer your property, then I may come and go as I please, true?
Forgive me, my lady. It's not my place to question you. I was just concerned.
Well, then perhaps I will tell you when I return. Now go see Lord Mulcibar and be nice. You don't have enough friends in Aragosh that you can afford to lose this one.
Yes, my lady. Have a good time. Oh, and take the soldiers with you when you go.
No, thank you.
Pardon?
If you must know, I'm going to see some of my friends at the palace, and they won't enjoy being surrounded by men with swords.
Tell the guards to wait outside. I'd just feel better if they escorted you.
Horace, I've been making my way through the city for a long time now, years longer than you have. I can take care of myself.
I know, but those things tried to kill both of us. If there are more of them, I don't think they'll think twice about trying again on an open street. Please, just take the guards.
All right, I'll take two men, but no more.
Thank you. Now I suppose I have to go entertain our guest while you're out gallivanting.
Alira gave him a withering glare, and Horace held up his good hand in a gesture of surrender.
I'm going.
Horace entered the parlor off the front vestibule. He put on a good face as he greeted Lord Mulcibar, who stood looking at a painting hung on the wall.
My lord?
Horace made a bow, but Mulcibar waved a hand at him.
None of that, if you please. I get enough of that at the palace.
Please sit. Would you like something to break your fast?
No, I've already eaten.
Horace took a seat on the divan. The nobleman sat in a chair facing the center of the room. He had brought a long, thin bundle wrapped in purple cloth, which he set beside his chair.
I wanted to check in on you. The commander of the Queen's Guard is an important post.
I don't feel very important. Then again, I suppose not everyone has demons trying to kill him.
Yes, quite. Since you broached the subject, I have been to your old suite to peruse the wreckage, shall we say?
How bad was it?
I am glad to say the palace will remain standing, although between the damage from the storm and your encounter, the royal engineers have their hands full. Judging by the evidence, the magnitude of energies you unleashed that night was impressive. Yet it was also quite evident that you lack precision.
I'm still working on that. Do you know what it was that attacked us?
I do.
Mulcibar reached into his impeccable gray robe and withdrew a glass bottle sealed with a cork, which he handed to Horace. A pile of teeth filled the bottom third of the bottle, each sharply pointed and much larger than human teeth. They looked like the fangs of a bear, a really big bear.
We call them Idimu. Our myths are filled with them, evil spirits that eat human flesh.
Do you know why they attacked us?
Not for certain, but part of the reason I've come today, besides congratulating you on your new home, is to warn you that you are now swimming in very dangerous waters.
More dangerous than washing up alone and helpless on the shore of your sworn enemies? More dangerous than being put in chains and collared like a dog?
Horace shook the bottle.
More dangerous than this?
Yes. As a captive and a slave, you enjoyed certain protections. Lord Isiratu, for instance, might have had to pay recompense if he'd killed you and later found out that another Zoanii, such as the Queen, had claimed to you. That's why he handed you over without protest. Once you passed into the Queen's possession, she was responsible for your welfare.
No offense, but she put me in a dungeon cell, my lord. She didn't seem too concerned about my welfare then.
On the contrary, you were well treated, given food and water, and most importantly, you were safe.
Are you saying I'm not anymore? Safe, that is.
Precisely. The court plays by a different set of rules. Status is everything. Sons will betray fathers to gain it. Wives will plot against their husbands and lovers. Nothing is beyond the pale.
What about the Queen? Why doesn't she stop it?
Whatever for? Her Majesty was born into this environment. She thrives on the unending conflict and retains much of her political power by playing the factions against each other.
I remember you gave me the same warning on the night of the Queen's party. So I'll ask you again. What do I do?
Obviously, you must tread carefully. Under normal circumstances, a new member of the Inner Circle is tested rigorously by the others. Yet your elevation to this position is unprecedented. The court will watch and wait, seeking to know your strength before they make a move. You must use this time to your advantage.
What about the Idimu?
I suspect they were a blunder.
That's one hell of a blunder.
Yes, they dwell beyond our world and must be summoned with sorcery. Not an easy feat, and one which only the darkest sorcerer would attempt.
Gilgan's brother?
Lord Jantu was my first suspect. However, he is innocent as far as I can determine. If anything, he appears more upset by his late brother's treason than anyone.
He would appear that way if you were engaged in the same conspiracy.
Lord Horace, I'd say you're adapting well to a Keshian society. In any case, discovering the identity of the culprit is now your duty as First Sword.
Lucky me.
Yes. In the meantime, we need to work on your self-control.
I've been trying those exercises you taught me.
Just thinking about them made Horace's head ache. Lord Mulcibar had instructed him in a series of mental puzzles, such as studying an object, like a painting or a glass vase, then closing his eyes and trying to keep that object in his mind for a duration of several minutes. Or the opposite, emptying his mind of all images or thoughts, and remaining that way, completely blank, for a similar period of time. He'd found these exercises to be much harder than they sounded. The point was to focus his mind on specific tasks, and thereby strengthen his connection to the Zoanna.
But they don't seem to be working. At least, not consistently.
Zoanni trained from the time they are children. You cannot expect to master the five arts in a single moon.
Five? I thought you said there were only four.
Each dominion comprises an art of Zoanna. The fifth art is Shinar, the study of the void.
What is the void?
Mulcibar picked up his bundle and gestured to the door leading to the garden. They went outside, where the bright, cloudless sky promised a fine day. Mulcibar stopped beside an orange tree.
Now, even your learned men understand that the heavens are a distant bowl inverted above the earth. The sun and the stars travel along this celestial dish above the sky, but there is a space between the heavens and the sky, an emptiness. This is the void.
Horace looked up. Above the roof of his house, he could see the edge of the sun surrounded by blue.
I don't see anything above the sky. It's all just air.
Shinar cannot be seen. It cannot be touched or smelled either. Yet the universe is connected by emptiness. The sky above our heads, the ground beneath our feet, the space between our breaths. The void exists in all these things. Understand the nothingness, and you will understand everything.
I'm sorry, but it sounds like pagan nonsense. If it can't be seen or felt, what use is it?
When the Idimu attacked in your bedchamber, which dominion did you employ to drive them away?
I couldn't see anything happening, but the demon, whatever you call it, felt it.
Creatures from the outside, as many Zoanii have discovered to their detriment, are resistant to the four traditional dominions. They can only be destroyed, as far as we know, by the power of Shinar.
All right, so I used the fifth dominion. Is that a problem? Like I said, I've been practicing the techniques you taught me.
You aren't understanding. Let me make this plain. There are no practitioners of Shinar in all of Akeshia. The last Zoanii rumored to control the void died more than 2 centuries ago. To say it is a rare talent would be a gross understatement. This also explains your affinity with the Chaos Storms, and perhaps your lack of Immaculata as well. We have precious little information about the Fifth Dominion. There's no record of the techniques required to control it or the risks involved.
Risks?
Shinar is more than an element of the world.
Mulcibar touched his chest and then his head.
When we Zoanii meditate to hone our precision with the power, it is the void we seek to comprehend. All of us fall short. Yet it is the search for that perfect nothingness that compels us to master Arzuana. But you apply the Shinar as easily as I am breathing this air.
I wouldn't say it's been easy.
Horus, I have been contemplating the void every day since I was 7 years old, and you already know it more fully and more deeply than I ever will. It staggers me to imagine what you will discover in the time to come, the wonders you will weave, if you survive.
There you go again with the risks and my survival. What's the danger? Am I going to explode or something?
The nobleman uncovered his bundle and rolled out a square rug on the pavestones. It was about 4 feet on each side and stitched with an intricate design of geometric shapes inside and around a wide golden circle. The interior designs included a series of concentric squares around another circle in black, which was divided into 4 quadrants surrounding an innermost circle of white. The rug's pattern was beautiful, but it was so elaborate that Horus found it difficult to focus on any single design.
This is a Gonzir mat. There are many variations. In fact, each family has its own unique version. This is the Gonzir of my house.
It's very nice.
Please, sit down.
They both got comfortable on the ground.
Your lack of control stems from an absence of inner harmony. The Gonzir is used to focus the mind, much like the hand positions I taught you. These designs impress upon the mind that everything is one. As above, so below.
Mulcibar indicated the center circle.
Here you see the wheel of the arts, with the 4 dominions surrounding the circle of the void. He who controls the emptiness also masters the other 4 dominions in conjunction.
Horus leaned over the mat for a closer look. There was a tiny design inside the innermost circle. It resembled a man sitting cross-legged, stitched in platinum thread.
So what do I do with it?
The key to your power is balance and harmony. Gaze upon the patterns and allow them to merge with your thoughts. The goal is to reach a state of heightened consciousness wherein you observe the entire universe at once.
Horus considered the nobleman's words. It was preposterous to think that looking at a carpet would help him control his powers, but he was willing to try for the old man's sake. Horus stared at the jumble of shapes and colors, letting his eyes roam across it without focusing on anything specific. Yet, as the minutes passed by, he found his gaze drawn again and again to the tiny figure sitting in the center circle. There was something odd about the figure, but he couldn't pinpoint what it was.
Now, try to access your Zoana. Allow it to flow naturally out of you.
Horus was surprised to find the magic already coursing through him at a low level. He tried to follow Mulcibar's instructions and let it out, but the power evaded his mental grasp. After about a dozen attempts, he gave up.
I can't. It won't come.
Try again.
I did, all right?
He stood up and dusted the seat of his robe.
Maybe your carpet doesn't work for me. I'm a savage, after all.
Mulcibar used his stick to lever himself to his feet.
Perhaps you are right.
Horus reached out to help him, but the nobleman waved him away.
I'm sorry, that was churlish of me. Thank you for everything.
No need to apologize. I hated my teachers in the art. Black-hearted bastards, every one of them. Of course, I was not the most attentive pupil. I lost count of how many sticks they broke across my back.
Do you think that would help me learn? I'm sure I could find some switches around here somewhere.
Master Horus?
Horus turned to see a servant girl waiting just outside the parlor door.
Dharma, right? What is it?
A messenger came through the door, sire. He left a package.
The girl moved aside, and one of Horus's guards carried a long box about the size of a map case past her. The man held it gingerly, as if afraid to break its contents.
Please set it on the bench.
After the guard left, Horus started to reach for the box, but Mulcibar stopped him with a word.
Wait. Please. Allow me to inspect it first.
You don't need to do that. I can get it.
What if the box has been inspelled? Can you spot a Rek'plag curse without touching the outer surface? Do you know the 13 anti-bindings that can be used to corrode a sorcerer's connection to the Zoana and cause his own power to rebound against him? Do you know what the toxin from a tsetse adder smells like?
The case looked innocent enough, made of dark wood with a rich varnish and brass fittings. Yet Horace stayed where he was.
Why don't you look it over first?
An excellent idea, my lord.
Mulcibar leaned over the case without touching it, making some gestures. An itch prickled the back of Horace's neck. After a few minutes, Mulcibar stepped back.
I do not find any tampering or enchantment on the package.
Horace reached out. The lid opened smoothly. Inside, a knife lay on a bed of white silk. The weapon was exquisite, with an ivory hilt inlaid with silver, but the blade was smeared with a reddish-brown substance. Horace peered closer, but did not touch it.
Is that...
blood, yes. It has started earlier than I imagined.
What's started?
A knife dipped in blood is a traditional challenge between rivals.
A challenge to what? A duel?
Mulcibar stepped past Horace and pulled a slip of blood-encrusted papyrus from beneath the knife's blade. He unrolled it and started to read.
I, Verazar, Lord of Perosis and Assam, do challenge thee, Horace of Tynes, the Queen's Protector, to fight me at the setting of the Holy Sun on the third day of Hekar before the gods and our city.
Horace peered at the message. The bottom was bordered by a long strip of printed wedge-shaped characters that formed the Lord's signature. Alira had shown him how they were formed with clay cylinders dipped in ink and rolled across the parchment. Each was unique to an individual.
Sounds serious.
A duel between Zoanii is to the death.
What if I refuse?
It will weaken your standing in court. Also, your name will be mocked in public.
Fine. I've dealt with worse. I refuse.
Horace took the piece of papyrus and tore it in half, and then in half again, before dropping them back in the box.
Let them talk.
Mulcibar watched him with pensive eyes. Alira held her cloak shut with one hand and her hood pulled low with the other as she hustled through the dim avenue. The last thing she wanted was to be recognized. Sefkahet, also concealed within a long cloak, glanced about as she accompanied Alira through the narrow streets. Yesterday evening, Alira had found a message on her dressing table saying merely, "Night has fallen." It was code, of course. A code she never thought she'd see. Night was the code name for the head of the Nemedian spy service, a person so cloaked in mystery that neither Alira nor any of the operatives she'd known could say if Night was male or female. The message meant simply that Knight was here, in the city. Then, this morning, another message arrived on the edge of her bathtub. It gave only a time and a place. She had been summoned. She had left her bodyguards at the palace with orders that they be plied with cool drinks and plenty of female companionship to occupy their time. Sefkahet met her at one of the palace's side gates, and together they left the compound. They entered a part of the city known as the Dredge, a warren of narrow streets and mud-brick tenements abutting the river district. Shadowed alleyways, like cave tunnels, twisted between rows of beer shops and drug dens, where sleepy-eyed people smoked the pollens of exotic flowers to escape their daily lives. The houses were stacked atop each other, their edges jutting out over the dirty street to block out most of the sky. A dark place for dark dealings. The funny thing was, lying to Horace had been the most nerve-wracking part of it. He'd been good to her and more honorable than she had any right to expect, considering that she had been a slave under his control. And his fear for her safety was genuine. Yet there was more to it than that, more to him. He had a sadness that she couldn't penetrate. It was almost as if... Alira stopped in the middle of the street as people brushed past her. Sefkahet kept walking for a few steps and then paused to look back with a pained expression. Alira ignored the woman as she sifted through her last conversation with Horace.
For a moment, I was somewhere else.
Alira didn't know what had triggered it, but in that instant when Horace was remembering some past event, a look of such sorrow had crossed his face that she thought he might break down.
He's lost someone and he's holding it in.
Suddenly, things about Horace made more sense. His gentleness, the awkward way he tried not to stare at her when she was undressed, his insistence on setting her free, they all stemmed from this traumatic loss. As Alira put the pieces together, a cold realization came over her.
The court is going to tear him to pieces,
Those jackals can smell fear, and he's emotionally defenseless.
Alira, we must go!
Alira hurried onward, her thoughts divided between Horace and the interview before her. They took several turns, careful out of habit to be sure they weren't being followed, until they arrived at a small blue door set below street level between two potted meshugan trees. This was where she often came to report and receive new instructions. While Sefkahet waited in a shadowed alcove across the street, Alira descended a short flight of steps. The wait seemed interminable, but finally the peek hole opened and a jaundiced eye surrounded in black coal peered out.
Peace be upon your home and your hearth until the end of days.
The door opened, and Alira hurried inside. The old woman who let her in, whose name she'd never learned and never asked, secured the door with three bolts and a heavy chain before ushering her down the dark hallway to the rear of the house. Among those who served the spy ring, names were usually left unknown unless there was a reason. Alira supposed the old woman might be the house's owner. She was a native of Aragosh. That much Alira knew from the few words they had exchanged over the years. Each of Akeshia's city-states had a distinct way of speaking if one had an ear for accents. The back room was dark except for a candle in a tin dish sitting in the center of a plain wooden table. The windows were draped in thick brocade that blocked out exterior light. A male voice spoke in the darkness beyond the candlelight.
Alira Dubrows?
Yes.
Do you know who I am?
I believe you might be Knight.
That is correct. Do you know why you're here?
There are several possibilities, such as the recent attack on the palace, or the incident with the Queen's ship.
We are aware of these events. No, it was your report on the apparatus you claim that the Akeshians have built under this city. I wanted to hear it from you directly.
Which part, exactly?
All of it. Start at the beginning, when you first entered the underground tunnels.
Alira took a moment to compose her thoughts, and then began a lengthy narrative of the hour she'd spent in Lord Astapta's lair.
You say that you suspect this machine may be intended to affect the Chaos Storms. On what do you base this idea?
It's just a hunch. The energy inside the wire cage had the look of a storm, only much smaller.
But you admit you only got a brief look at it.
That's right.
The man emerged from the darkness. The stark light shone on the side of his face, while the opposite side lay in deep shadow. He was older than she imagined, with silver-gray hair cut short, almost down to the scalp, and a network of wrinkles across his cheek and mouth. His one visible eye, though, was clear and crystal blue.
You have our gratitude. You've done more in Aragosh than I ever imagined you could when I first approved your assignment here.
That sounds final.
It's time to come home, Alira.
I appreciate that, sir, I do. But I feel that there's more to do here. The mission isn't complete.
It is for you. You've earned a rest. I know it can be difficult leaving an assignment, but you've completed...
What are you going to do about Lord Astapta and the construction?
That decision will be made in due time. You're a fine field operative, Alira, but policy matters are not your responsibility.
Forgive me, but I think the people on the forefront of the operation, those serving here in the palace, are the ones in the best position to influence those decisions.
I remember thinking the same thing when I was a lot younger, and in the same position you're in now. But I learned that things must be done a certain way. Our country rests in a delicate position. I don't expect you to understand, but I have to weigh the interest of many against the desires of any one person. Yes, I thought as much.
Thought what?
Do you love him?
Of course not.
Good. Few things will ruin a good operative like falling in love with an asset.
I know my duty. I know why I'm here.
And I know why you're here, too. Revenge for your father, killed by the Akeshians. For your mother, left a widow and forced to beg to feed her child. For yourself, stripped of your past and your homeland by circumstances you couldn't control. Revenge is what you truly want, isn't it?
Yes.
Then you must sever your feelings for this Storm Lord. Use him. Make love to him. Tell him whatever you must to keep his trust, but never forget why you're here. Do you understand?
Then
I'm staying?
Yes. Everything will change with the Queen's wedding. If we fail in our mission, a Keshan power may grow beyond anyone's ability to overcome. Can I count on you?
Yes. What should I do next?
Your asset has become quite popular of late. Use this to our advantage. If he becomes a big enough distraction, it could give us some play in other areas. Encourage him to take chances, to utilize the powers of his new position.
What if he could be turned to our side?
Focus on the task at hand, Alira. Lord Horus is a convenient thorn in the Sun Cult's side at a time when we need the Akeshans distracted. Keep him on that path.
I understand.
Good. You are dismissed.
Sefkahet waited in the street. She flashed a smile when Alira emerged from the house, but it couldn't erase the worry lines etched around her pretty eyes and mouth. Alira could see she wanted to ask how it went, but held back.
It's all right, just a debriefing about my mission.
So you're staying in Erugash?
For now. I need to get back. Back to the First Sword's manor.
I hope the savage is not a cruel man. I'll be glad when you can return to the palace.
Yes. We all have our trials to endure.
The sun was setting behind the city's skyline as Horus returned to his new home with four bodyguards in tow. He had spent most of the day in a meeting of the Queen's War Council, where he'd been forced to endure hostile stares from the other nobles, while they droned on and on about some treaty, much of which he missed because they only spoke in Akeshian. It might have been more bearable if Alira had been able to attend with him, or even Lord Mulcibar. Anyone to help him make sense of this office he was supposed to be filling. A table in the vestibule was piled with flat scrolls bound in ribbon and sealed with wax. There were no servants in sight, so he inspected them himself. Each seal was impressed with a different signature roll, some of them quite ornate, with animals and strange symbols. Horace picked up one at random and broke the seal, noticing that his injured arm was getting better. He read the characters written on the papyrus. With Alira's help, his reading comprehension was actually better than his spoken Akeshian. The greeting was addressed to him.
To the Queen's First Sword, Horus of Arnos, in accordance with all the laws of Akeshia and the strictures of the heavenly spheres, I do hereby challenge you to a duel of honor on the 40th day.
Horus scanned the rest of the document, which just went on with flowery language to thrust home the point that he was duty-bound to answer this challenge.
Or be deemed unworthy in the eyes of man and the gods.
He dropped the scroll in the pile and opened another. The words were a bit different, but they amounted to the same thing. Another challenge. He counted the scrolls and arrived at 13. 13 challenges to fight to the death. He gathered them up and went to the kitchen, which was empty. He fed the scrolls into the brick oven and lifted the lid of the firebox in the corner, but the coals inside had gone cold. With a scowl, Horus pointed at the oven and envisioned a tongue of yellow flame consuming the parchments. Nothing happened. He clenched his fists in frustration.
God damn you all, you sons of whores.
A rush of heat exploded in his chest, like the door to the hottest furnace imaginable had opened inside him. He flinched back as bright green flames erupted from the oven, rising almost to the ceiling. Squeezing his eyes shut, Horus focused on closing the flow of energy. After a few moments, the fire died down. He leaned against the nearest wall. He was bathed in sweat.
Control. I have to learn better control, or Lord Mulcibar is right. I'm going to hurt someone.
With that thought in mind, Horus went to the armoire in his bedchamber and retrieved the Ganzir mat. He unrolled it on the floor and sat down. As before, the intricate designs drew his eyes in several different directions. It was so chaotic he couldn't concentrate on any one part. Then, leaning closer, he noticed there was a specific distance at which the patterns on the mat coalesced into a harmonious pattern. Though he allowed his gaze to wander freely, he found himself always coming back to the platinum man sitting in the center of the Ganzir. His shoulders relaxed as he felt the tension leaving his body. He attempted to open his ka. A tickle fluttered in the pit of his stomach. He felt a pulling in the muscles of his midsection as his body seemed to get heavier, and a grounded sensation came over him. He had opened himself to the dominion of Earth. Kishargal, Mulcibar had called it. It felt good, like he was more in control of the power. He looked beyond the mat to the slate tiles that made up the floor of his room. Wondering if he could break one free, he lifted his hand. A sense of strain gathered in the back of his head.
Horus?
Horus closed his connection to the Zoana. The heaviness left him as he climbed to his feet. Alira had changed into a light blue tunic and sandals with calf-high bindings.
Horus, I need to talk to you.